This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. An article in this week's Time magazine asked the question, are there more Michael Browns out there, more political appointees who don't have a lot of expertise in their area but are responsible for decisions that will affect our safety? The article concludes that at top positions in some vital government agencies, the Bush administration is putting connections before experience. My guest Mike Allen co-wrote this piece. He joined Time magazine this month as a White House correspondent. He previously worked for the Washington Post, where he covered the Bush White House for 4 years, then covered Capitol Hill. The Time article points out that a benign cronyism is more or less presumed, with old friends and big donors getting comfortable positions and impressive titles. But according to the article, what's going on now is different.
What my colleagues Karen Tumulty, Mark Thompson, and I looked at was if there was something different about the way the Bush administration was shaping the bureaucracy. And we actually were digging into this story before Michael Brown, the outgoing head of FEMA, came into the news. But he sort of served as an obvious case study to look at whether there were people in the government who'd been chosen more for their connections than for their competence. So often patronage jobs are people who are hidden in the bureaucracy or have a job like ambassador or something where there's only so much harm you can do. Now in a time when there's threats at home and abroad, the bureaucracy can matter. And we saw that on a grand scale down in New Orleans. We saw that it matters whether you know how to and are able to reach down into the bureaucracy and ask someone to drop diapers on the Superdome. There is a way to do that, but you have to know how to do it.
Well, let's look at some of the Bush administration appointees. Let's start with somebody at Homeland Security Department. And your article says that a well-connected White House aide with minimal experience is poised to take over what many consider the single most crucial post in ensuring that terrorists do not enter the country again. She worked briefly for Michael Chertoff as his chief of staff when he was at the Justice Department. And she just married Chertoff's current chief of staff. Her uncle is Air Force General Richard Myers. So what are some of the questions surrounding the nominee Julie Myers to head Immigration Customs Enforcement?
Well, Terry, Julie is someone who has very close professional and family ties to the administration, someone that they're very comfortable with. Now, when she went up for her confirmation hearing, senators debated whether or not she met the statutory minimum for that job of 5 years of management experience. Now, she convinced them that she did, but some of the senators expressed to me surprise that they were confronting a nominee who it was debatable or a close call whether or not they were minimally qualified. Now, I talked to Senator Susan Collins of Maine, who was one of the senators raising those questions, and she said she now is satisfied that Ms. Myers met that requirement. But the point that she made to me is Ms. Myers would not be her choice, but it's someone that the Secretary of Homeland Security, Michael Chertoff, is comfortable with, someone the White House is comfortable with. And so as opposed to bringing in an outsider to learn the Bush culture, this is an example of a younger person from the extended family who's being put in a big and important job.
You mentioned the importance of already knowing the Bush culture. Do you think there are times when being comfortable in the Bush culture and understanding the Bush culture is considered more important than bringing expertise in the field?
Of course, what they would tell you is that they look for both. But a very important question as they're vetting potential candidates is he a Bushy? Is she a Bushy? And by that, that's meant, is it someone who has been around either the campaign or the administration, somebody who understands the way they do things, who understands their culture of message discipline, and who understands their culture of always putting the focus spotlight on the president. Microphone hoggers, camera hoggers are not invited. And that's why in this administration, you have a lot of, even at the cabinet secretary level, people who are devoted to Bush or who have connections to this administration, but are not necessarily stars or authorities in their fields. And a notable exception would be Colin Powell, Secretary of State, and we saw what happened to him.
Let's move on to David Safavian, and he was the chief procurement officer. He was appointed in 2003. He resigned on September 16th of this year, and then shortly after that was arrested and charged with lying and obstructing a criminal investigation into Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff. So what experience and qualifications did he bring to the position of chief procurement officer? And perhaps you should describe what that position actually is.
Yeah, well, they're partly responsible for purchasing decisions by the government. And the Office of Management and Budget has emphasized to me that he doesn't have that sole authority that no person does. But Clay Johnson, who, Terry, you remember him, he came to Washington with then-Governor Bush from Austin and was the director of the transition, was the first director of personnel, and so is in many ways the architect of this personnel system that you and I are describing. He hired Mr. Safavian, and he told me that he was the most qualified of the three or four people who were chosen. But certainly it was an embarrassment when last week he was arrested in connection with this case. Now, the administration makes the point that that was unrelated to his duties. But this was the first time, I think, that the Abramoff case had been visibly, publicly, specifically brought into the White House. And Clay Johnson gave a very candid account of how Mr. Safavian came to be there. And he says that Safavian mentioned before his background check that there might be an issue, that he'd had some connection to some people, as Mr. Johnson put it. Now, after the FBI check, after this went through the White House counsel's office, he was cleared. And so he did take the job. But that certainly raises a question about what the standards are. If the candidate knows that they might be questionable, it's quite amazing that they would survive that screening process.
Somebody else who you write about in your article on Bush administration cronyism is Scott Gottlieb. In July, he was named Deputy Commissioner for Medical and Scientific Affairs at the FDA. He's one of three FDA deputies. And you write about questions concerning his financial ties to the drug industry. What are those connections?
Well, because of work he'd done previously, Mr. Gottlieb had to recuse himself from dealing with issues that involved many of the major drug companies in America, which makes you question how effectively he can do his job if he has to recuse himself. I saw the letter, this long list of drug companies. And this is a case where you have the political people who are coming in, those 3,000, who clash with the career or civil service people who are there. Scientists on the FDA staff told my colleague Karen Tumulty that they felt intimidated or they felt constricted by questions that he was asking about decisions they'd made about drugs. And we got some of the emails that he had sent second-guessing decisions that they'd made, questioning either even whether these questions should have come up. And anybody who gets an email from their boss second-guessing them, it certainly is going to affect what you're going to do next time. And so there's a lot of people in the FDA who say, you know, this is meddling by politicians, which is inappropriate. Now, Scott Gottlieb has said that he does stay away from decisions like that, and we had a long string of administration people phone us up to tell us how qualified he was.
Your article mentions that before he became an FDA commissioner, Gottlieb was the editor of the Forbes Gottlieb Medical Technology Investor, which was a Wall Street newsletter about medical and biotech investments.
Right. And so that's what makes the scientist question his involvement in the decisions. To them, he's a 33-year-old stock picker, not someone who's an authority in their areas. And Terry, this raises the question about people from an industry coming in and then regulating that industry. And again, this is something that was ever thus. But the FDA is an example of where this is a life and death decision, where consumers depend on the FDA to protecting them. And what you'll have critics of the administration saying is these people have been trained in industry, focused on the lobbying agenda, what that industry is after. Then they go into the administration and they go right to work, that there's not a learning curve, that people from industry know what they want to do the moment they hit the ground in the administration.
Your article also writes about inspector general positions, and these are positions that were created after Watergate, and they're supposed to be hired without regard to political affiliation. What do inspector generals do, and why did your article raise questions about those appointments?
Yeah, Terry, there are 57, 8, 9, something like that, inspectors general in the federal government, And these are some people who are the internal watchdogs in a department or agency. So someone who works, for example, in the State Department and is charged with looking for and exposing waste, fraud, abuse in that department. So it's a little like internal affairs for a police department. And these positions are even more important now that you have an administration that has the same party in power running Congress. This Congress has taken a generally passive approach to oversight of this administration. So the inspector generals can be the last check on the government. And at the higher levels, these are presidentially appointed positions, and a number of the people who have been in these positions have close family or political ties. The best known example is Janet Rehnquist, daughter of the late Chief Justice, who was the Inspector General at the Department of Health and Human Services. Henry Waxman, a Democrat of California, the chief Democrat on the Government Affairs Committee, did a study of all the AGs and that found that the ones appointed by President Bush, roughly 60% of them had Republican political connections, and roughly 25% had former audit experience, which in the statute is supposed to be the sort of deciding point, is technical expertise like that. In the Clinton administration, according to this study, those numbers were roughly reversed, that roughly 60% had audit experience, only maybe a quarter had political experience, a striking difference.
How much time does Congress actually spend in the confirmation process of the positions that we're talking about?
Well, Terry, you raise a great and timely issue, because there's a number of congressmen, there's a number of senators who've been embarrassed to have their quotes read back to them from Michael Brown's confirmation hearing when he was confirmed for a lower level post at the Federal Emergency Management Agency. He was not confirmed to be director, but he was confirmed earlier. And among the senators who were lauding praise on him was Joseph Lieberman, a Democrat of Connecticut. Now, of course, Michael Brown is the whipping boy for much of what went wrong for the federal government in Louisiana. I was surprised when Karen Hughes came up for her confirmation hearing to be one of the deputy secretaries of state in charge of all the public diplomacy and public affairs, runs a huge empire, is going to be one of the administration's most visible faces, is in the Middle East at this moment, appearing for the administration, is someone who has been a ground zero throughout the administration, can answer any question about anything that the president has done. Not one Democrat showed up at her confirmation hearing. A huge press corps showed up, and we thought it was going to be a great show. She'd been prepared for tough questioning because she knew there would be cameras there, and her theory was that that would mean that Democrats were there. She had a private meeting with Senator Biden, a Democrat of Delaware, the day before, and he actually supported her. And then the next day, I believe it was a Friday, or it was a day at least that the Senate was gone, no one was there.
You've been covering the White House for several years. I'm wondering about the position of Karl Rove now. Over the summer, the Valerie Plame investigation was a big story. Judith Miller is still in prison. And questions have been raised about what Karl Rove's involvement was in leaking that Valerie Plame, or Valerie Wilson, her married name, was a CIA agent. And was that payback for the fact that her husband reported that the Bush administration's allegations about Saddam Hussein trying to buy yellow cake in Africa were incorrect? So how has that affected, if at all, Rove's standing and power within the Bush administration?
I'm told that this case has really taken a toll on some of the people in the White House. After 5 years, and a lot of them worked in the governor's mansion before that, the presidential campaign before that, a lot of these people are just tired, understandably. These days in the White House are 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. when nothing is going on, and longer than that when there is a crisis. And partly because of the uncertainty, partly because it's clear that there's more White House involvement than was known or described in the beginning. I'm told that is affecting people. Mr. Rose specifically says that he was not the source of Ms. Plame, Ms. Wilson's identity. But it's clear from some of the information that's come out that a reporter or two probably considered him their source. If you look at the plain language of their stories, they appear to have depended on Mr. Rove. Now, Mr. Rove's attorney has said he's been assured by the prosecutor that he's not a target of this investigation, but it is a big question mark. I know that it has not hampered Mr. Rove internally. He's as important as ever. His shop is the sort of idea cooker for the administration. They're the hub of input from all over the country. He's the network that sort of keeps track of the grassroots around the country. As you know, from the beginning, Mr. Rove's formal title has been senior advisor to the president. As you know, in this second term, he also is one of two deputy chiefs of staff. What's going to happen to the Plame case is one of the big unknowns that sort of hangs over the second term. And I think that there will be great relief when that is settled one way or the other.
In the meantime, what is Karl Rove's role in overseeing the rebuilding of New Orleans?
What's interesting about Mr. Rove is he can have the last word on anything that he wants to, but he doesn't necessarily have operational control over everything. I think there's this urban myth that he pulls the levers for absolutely everything, and there's no question that he can stop or get the ball rolling when he wants to. But there is, inside the White House specifically, a Katrina response task force, and it's headed by the other deputy chief of staff, Joe Hagan, the one who frequently is with the president at the ranch when he's in Austin. And it used to be Josh Bolton, who also was a deputy chief of staff. But Joe Hagan is my nominee for White House official with the most power and the least attention. Joe Hagan can decide everything in the White House, from your salary to your BlackBerry to where the president's going. And he's added Katrina to his portfolio. And the White House is putting out reports that sum up these fat reports that they're sending to the Hill that sum up what each department is doing in response to Katrina to show that it is a government-wide effort. So what you'll see is Mr. Rove making strategic decisions, such as he'd have a lot of input, for example, in where the president will visit, and you have other people with operational day-to-day responsibility.
The Washington Post recently had a story, you know, has the president lost his swagger? Do you think that in any, like, literal way, the president has changed lately? Does he look different to you? Did he physically have a swagger that he no longer has?
This is a president whose trademark quality was certainty, that he always knew what he was going to do and stuck to it, even if other people, even if people inside thought he should be adjusting course. Now you've had a succession of bad news. There have been very little positive news for this White House since the president was reelected. You had the brief euphoria about the elections in Iraq, which was no small thing. And they're very excited about the success of Roberts and how smoothly that went, partly because of White House operations. And they're discouraged because if it weren't for Katrina, all the news would be about how great things were with Roberts. But with the president now, you have someone who's having to readjust the way he does things, the way he thinks about things. The president's concession that more could have been done or different things could have been done with Katrina was very uncharacteristic of him. And a lot of my colleagues were struck by how different his tone was in the speech he gave urging Americans to conserve energy. That just has not been the Bush message. And so it's an example of how he's trying to find his footing, find a new message in the post-Katrina world. What the administration is very intent on avoiding is having the bookends of the administration be 9/11 and Katrina. That's a storyline that a lot of people in the media are sort of picking up, and the White House is intent on being sure the president is remembered for something besides that. At the moment, you have uncertainty, something you rarely saw in this White House, and that's where you see the curtailed, at the very least, swagger.
Well, Mike Allen, thank you very much for talking with us.
This was fun. Thanks, Terry.
Mike Allen is a White House correspondent for Time magazine. He co-wrote this week's article, How Many More Mike Browns Are Out There? I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.